So hi, my name is Michael Lindsay. I bring greetings from Boston. Any other folks from New England who are here? God bless your souls. We're glad to have more faithful few up in New England and delighted to be here at the Gospel Coalition. Today I want to share with you some things that I've spent the last 10 years of my life working on. This actually is a line of research that I began in my doctoral program at Princeton and wrote a book that came out of the first phase of the study called Faith in the Halls of Power. It started off as a project where I was hoping to be able to interview 40 prominent leaders in different sectors of American public life who were committed evangelicals. In the end, I did 360 face-to-face interviews. I then assumed a faculty position at Rice University in Houston and had dinner with the president one night, and he said, if you had all the money in the world and could do any research project, what would you do? And I said, I'd love to be able to extend the work that I've done for my dissertation into a larger project that looks at the networks, upbringing, and motivations of senior leaders, where I wouldn't necessarily be screening them on faith dimensions, but looking at moral questions within their leadership. He helped me get some funding and in the end was able to complete that. The largest study like this that had ever been done was conducted in 1970 by a team of researchers at Columbia University. It was called the American Leadership Study. For that project, they interviewed 545 senior leaders. I'm happy to say I beat that record by five people, so 550 interviews. My very first interview was with Richard Mao, the president of Fuller Seminary, and my very last interview was with Drew Faust, the president of Harvard. So it covers coast to coast and theological gamut and all things in between, and it was a great project. Today I'd like to share with you some things that I learned about how great leaders are developed and what we might learn about their experiences. Like I said, the project includes sort of a who's who of senior leaders. Folks who I interviewed in the project include former Presidents Carter and Bush, cabinet secretaries like Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Donna Shalala, heads of federal bureaus and agencies like the head of the Peace Corps, the head of the National Institutes of Health. I also interviewed 250 CEOs. 20 of the current Fortune 100 CEOs are in the study, including Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase, Randall Stephenson at AT&T, Michael Duke at Walmart. It also includes heads of some of the leading nonprofits in the world, the American Cancer Society, American Red Cross, as well as the presidents of Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, Duke, a number of other institutions. So what did I learn over all these 550 interviews about how we might develop leaders who might in the process become people of public influence and integrity? That's what I'd like to share with you today. In God's providence, we all start with two things, basically, opportunity and potential. And we have them in differing degrees. Opportunity. One of the things that I think we are called in our responsibilities of pastoral leadership to do is to try and create opportunities so that other people can serve and flourish. Just literally, while walking here to this session, I was reading an email from a colleague on campus. I serve as the president of Gordon College in Boston. And it was an email in which a colleague was basically saying, why is it that so often we think about leadership as being about how we can use our role to get things that we want done as opposed to helping other people get the things that they want done? And I think that that's right. Too often we focus on how authority, responsibility, and positions create opportunity for ourselves and not for those folks that we can help along the way. This is Tom Johnson. Tom Johnson grew up in Macon, Georgia, and started working for the publisher of the Macon Telegraph. Interesting guy who took a real interest in Tom very early on. Tom was enormously talented, but he didn't have a lot of opportunity. Came from a relatively poor family. They didn't have a lot of higher degrees. And in the end, this publisher paid for him to go to the University of Georgia. While he was at the University of Georgia, he commuted back to Macon to be able to work on this newspaper every single week. And then it turned out that publisher created opportunities for him to be able to go and study at Harvard Business School. While he was at Harvard Business School, President Johnson in 1964 announced the creation of a new program called the White House Fellowship. Tom applied for it, and in the end, he was selected. Tom ended up working directly with Bill Moyers and other folks in the president's communications staff, and then he went on to a very successful career He was the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, and he was the CEO of CNN. He was the person who made the decision to lay the different cables to Baghdad that would be separate communication links and separate power links to Baghdad so that their journalists would be able to continue reporting even if the city lost power or communication links. And because of that decision, the world watched the first Gulf War on CNN. That entire journey of leadership came about because one man, this man who was the publisher of the Macon Telegraph, took an interest in one young man and created an opportunity for him. We also are blessed because we have varying degrees of potential. One of the key things I think about leadership is identifying who are those folks who have the most potential in your midst. Pastors, I find, are very uniquely situated to identify promising people because they see people in ways different than a boss or a teacher or even a parent. You have a chance to observe people in a very different kind of environment. This is Diane Yu. Diane Yu, as a young woman, was a successful lawyer who went to go work for Clayton Yutter, who was our U.S. trade representative. Diane was a very, very talented woman, intellectually gifted, and she had an uncanny ability to remember the most minute details from conversations. Clayton decided that he would use that talent in some of the trade negotiations that were going on. He would invite Diane to come and sit in on these meetings. Now, she was a junior staffer, and most of the senior representatives didn't think that she knew what was going on. She took no notes, but she listened for the entire conversation. Then the minute that the meeting ended, she went back to her hotel room and was able to transcribe basically the entire conversation. That became a competitive advantage for the U.S. in these trade negotiations. How in the world did the Americans remember all these minor details? Because nobody was taking notes. Well, Diane Yu was our secret weapon. What we find is that all along the way, people can have these different kinds of potentials that we can develop. You never know when somebody's unusual talent, an ability to remember small arcane details, can end up making a difference on a global scale. Today, Diane serves as the chief of staff at NYU. NYU has probably become the world's leading institution of building global campuses. So far, not only do they have the campus in Lower Manhattan, but they also have built a campus in Abu Dhabi and are opening this fall a new campus in Shanghai. Diane is the driving force behind it. And she got that opportunity because Clayton Yutter was willing to take an interest in a young staffer, invite her to a couple of meetings to see what she could do. Relationships are really the key in terms of developing the next generation of leaders. If you don't hear anything else, hear that. It's not about a program, it's not about a strategy, it's fundamentally about the relationship between a master and a disciple, between teacher and student, between a mentor and a protege. One of the key things that I learned over the course of doing all of this study with meeting these amazing people is that we find relationships that are outside of the leadership network oftentimes are far more influential on really big decisions. In my own field of sociology, people assume that the people in power, the Jamie Dimons of the world, runs JP Morgan Chase, that he's influenced by his fellow CEOs and that that's the most pervasive influence on his life and on his decision making. Actually, I found that's almost never the case. Instead, if you really want to understand what makes Jamie Dimon work or what makes President Obama work, you need to look at the relationships that had a formative influence over a much longer span of time when they were far beyond and outside of the inner circle of power. People like troop leaders play very significant difference. Actually, scouting is a very important and formative organization in the development of CEOs in this country. Sunday school teachers found countless examples of very powerful folks who are in significant positions of responsibility who were deeply influenced by particular Sunday school teachers and family. It's interesting because this is a story about a young girl who changed the world. Her mom, there on the right, developed cancer when she was at age 15. The daughter at the time was a bit of a prodigy. She had some musical talent. She was intellectually gifted. Her parents decided that they would send her to college early, and she went at a time when racial integration was not embraced. She ended up going and studying in the Rockies, earned an undergraduate degree, and then was admitted to a doctoral program. Over the span of time, her mother continued to be battling cancer, and so they used various forms of chemotherapy basically to extend the life of the mother, but not to heal her of the cancer. And as it turned out, the mother died when the daughter was age 30. So 15 years that her life was extended through those chemotherapy drugs. Over that span of time, the daughter ended up completing her undergraduate degree, her master's degree, and her doctorate, and she took her very first teaching position at Stanford. As it turns out, those were very important years, and that particular sequence of events changed human history, because that woman on the left is Condoleezza Rice. Condoleezza Rice was in a conversation in 2002 in the Oval Office. It was a principals meeting where the key folks were making a decision around President Bush, whether or not the president would endorse PEPFAR, the president's relief program to try and allocate $15 billion worth of aid to address the AIDS pandemic on the continent of Africa, the most significant form of international aid in human history. And it was being advocated by a conservative Republican, not something we would expect. The conversation came around to say, is it really worth the money for us to be able to extend the life of these mothers and fathers who have AIDS if we know that they're going to die by the time they're 25 or 30? And there was internal debate, and after maybe an hour or so, Condoleezza Rice spoke up and she said, you know, actually I have personal experience with this. Let me tell you the story about my mom. You see, when I was 15, she was diagnosed with cancer. And the doctor said it was terminal, but that there was some medication that would allow her to extend the life. She said, I would not trade those 15 years for anything. And if we, the most powerful country in the world, could extend the life of those mothers and fathers so that their kids could grow up and the parents could see them get married, maybe have a kid of their own, it would change the continent of Africa. And if we don't do that, and it's within our power to do it, well, it's a moral failure on our leadership. So it turns out the vote was unanimous. They decided to allocate the $15 billion relief, and today PEPFAR is probably the most significant public policy accomplishment of President Bush's administration. And it really emerged out of a personal relationship between Condoleezza and Angelina Rice. Teachers have formative influences. This is Kenneth Langone, who was the founder of Home Depot, a very successful entrepreneur. And basically, he says that the reason why he succeeded in business is because he had a professor in college who told him that his writing was terrible, his grammar was abysmal, but he had a good sense for economics. And at a point when he considered dropping out from school, he had a college professor take a real interest in him. And as a result, he was willing to stick with it. One of the things that really stood out to me over the course of all these interviews is how individual anecdotes, a single conversation in which the other person probably has no idea the impact that it made, and yet it actually changed this person's life, and that person ended up doing something tremendously significant. That's the story of Kenneth Langone, and it occurs through the influence of a college professor. Mentors come in three different shapes and sizes. First, you have the challenger. It's a very interesting, relevant story to today. I had the chance to first meet a guy named Mike Ullman about 10 years ago. At the time, Mike had just stepped down as the head of Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, the luxury goods conglomerate based in Paris. He was being courted to assume the head position at a retail giant here in the United States. And he told me the story about how early on, he had the chance to go work for Federated Department Stores, their local store in Dallas, Texas, called Sanger Harris. And he had had a high-flying career as a young professional, and then he was recruited to come and work at Sanger Harris. So he went to go work there, and he said he was basically managing a warehouse at the time. And he had the chance, he applied for and was selected to be the chief financial officer of Yale University. That's a big deal for somebody who's like 35 years old. So he goes to his boss and says, you know, basically, I want to tell you what's happening in my life and see what you're, you know, what you think. And he said, honestly, I thought by telling him, he would suddenly decide to give me a big raise and then everything would be good because I really didn't want to go to Yale anyway. I was really happy in Dallas. He goes and sees the boss, and the boss says, you know what? I think you ought to take that job at Yale. And he said, really? And he said, yeah, you need that job. And Mike said, what do you mean I need that job? He said, I think you are so insecure that you need the validation that comes from being associated with Yale University. And so my recommendation is that you'll always feel like there's a gap in your life unless you take this job. That was the challenger mentor. Basically, his boss said, you know, I think what you're looking for is validation, and actually I want to sort of push back at you. In the end, Mike decided to stay with Sanger Harris, and it changed retailing history because Mike ended up being the CEO of JCPenney from 2004 until 2012. When he took that job, the company was on the brink of bankruptcy. By the time he left the job, 40% of American families were doing business with JCPenney every year. They had higher customer satisfaction scores than Nordstrom's and higher employee engagement scores than Starbucks. He was succeeded by a guy named Ron Johnson, who came in, who had been the head of Apple and their retail outlet, had a lot of radical ideas about how to change the company. And if you've read the paper today, you know that JCPenney's decided that they would get rid of Ron Johnson. And guess who they brought back into the job? None other than Mike Ullman. Literally, I spoke with him last night on the phone, told him I was going to say something about him today. So, Mike, we're thinking about you. But you never know how the challenger mentor can stay with you for a long period of time. It's one of the ways in which I found senior leaders actually developed in significant ways. Most of us think about mentors as the people who sort of make us feel good about ourselves, when in fact I found a lot of times they're the folks who give us a kick in the seat of the pants. Second is the social investor. This is somebody who says, I believe in what you're doing and I'm going to try and help you go to the next stage. There's a wonderful guy, a commercial real estate developer here in Orlando named Peter Fox. And he went to go work for a man here in the area early on in his career. And as it turns out, that man developed colon cancer and decided he was going to sell the business. One day, he called Peter and said, Peter, I'm going to sell the business to you. Peter said, I can't buy it. I don't have the money. And he said, I know. I'm going to loan you the money so that you can buy the business so you can take over it because I want to invest in you. That notion of sort of investing in somebody, I find is pervasive. All these people I interviewed, they're all talking about how somebody was willing to invest in them. There's a folder that I started building in my email inbox called Assisting Others. And it really came out of a couple of conversations I had over the course of my research. I decided that I wanted to try and do what I saw other folks doing, investing in other people. And so I try pretty much every day to make an introduction to somebody else, help somebody land a job or make recommendations. And what I do is every 6 months or so, I check the size of the different folders of my email folders, the size of those boxes, to see if assisting others is the largest box. That's my goal, that I'd have the most messages or the most activity that's going on there. That's the kind of accountability that I think we need if we want to be the social investors. And I found that those are very significant mentors along the way. Third and final kind of mentor that I found would be the role model. And this is what you expect. Roxanne Spillett serves as the head of Boys and Girls Club of America, lives in Atlanta. But she got to that role because she observed up close the woman who ran Girl Scouts of the USA for a number of years, Frances Hesselbein. Frances started a habit early in her career that she would hold an annual Christmas party. And she normally would invite the major donors, the major supporters of the organization, board members, and senior management people. But she always made a point of inviting a handful of people at much lower levels of the organization. They had no idea why they got invited, but they got invited because Frances wanted to begin to have an influence on them. She thought that they had exceptional promise. She was very intentional. She would invite them to come to the dinner at her house, and then she would try and figure out ways over the course of the coming year to just simply check in with that person. But it turns out Frances became a tremendous role model in the life of Roxanne. These kinds of ways I found came up all the times where folks were trying to make a real positive difference. Role model is probably what you and I think of when we think of a mentor. It's just one of three approaches. So these relationships that folks form early on, they actually become far more significant than we realize. Social science research shows we're deeply, deeply influenced by folks who have an impact on us before we head off to college. And I also find that folks many times will bring the values that they develop as a young person into their own new context. One of the things I'm interested in as a college president of a Christian college that really wants to try and honor the Lord as an institution is how do we awaken and develop the moral imagination of our students who we think will be the future leaders of the church. How do we do that? The goal is not necessarily for us to tell them, here are all the things that you should do or not do. Because frankly, that would take far longer than 4 years for us to cover that. Instead, what we want to do is to help them prepare of the good decisions that they would make even in an unrecognizable future. I cannot predict the moral conundrum that will be gripping our country 20 years from now. Neither can you. So our job is to figure out how do we help them to build the kind of apparatus that will help them to manage that with integrity. This is Gerard Arpey. Gerard Arpey was a lifelong executive in the airline industry. He served as the CEO of American Airlines. It's interesting because when I sat down to interview him in the spring of 2011, Gerard was facing tremendous challenges at American. All of the other airline companies had declared bankruptcy as a way of restructuring their long-term debt. And for Gerard, he felt like that would be a moral failure because in essence, American didn't really need it in order to restructure their debt. It was the easiest, most comfortable way to handle the problem. And so he said, for me and for American at this moment under my leadership, bankruptcy would be a moral failure. So I was very interested to see what happened when one morning I was in St. Louis, turn on the morning news and find out that morning American Airlines was declaring bankruptcy. It was in November of 2011. And I was curious to see what Gerard would do because I knew that that wasn't what he felt like he should do. In the end, he stepped down as CEO. And by stepping down, he gave up a very large sort of golden parachute package that he was eligible for. And he had nowhere else to land. There was nothing that he was expecting to do. Once you've been CEO of American Airlines, it's not like Delta's going to pick you up. So it's a difficult sort of context. I wrote a piece about Gerard because I really think that he exemplifies a sort of moral gravitas that our students need to see a lot more. People who are willing to stand up for their core convictions and values. This is not a judgment call about bankruptcy. There's all kinds of ways in which you can say the bankruptcy laws in this country create an opportunity for organizations and individuals to start over again, and there's much good. The story that I want to tell is how one leader who became convinced of a moral conviction did not waver on that when there was financial benefits for giving up on that. That's a good news story, and it's one that we have to tell. What we want, in essence, is to try and help the Bible to be moved beyond the sense that it's some kind of reductive moral code, and instead to be the articulation of a compelling moral vision. If we want to develop the moral imagination of young people today, they've got to be captured by that vision for the good, the true, the beautiful, for the flourishing. So I use Jeremiah 29 often when talking with our students about how important it is for us to try and contribute to the flourishing of the people around us and the communities around us. Remember, the prophet says, don't worry that you've been taken into exile. Plant gardens and settle down. Marry, have sons and daughters, and invite them to be married off, because God's carried you to this place, and if it prospers, you too will prosper. That's what we need to do, that notion of the flourishing. So, how do we bring that about? Well, one is where we think of moral imagination addressing our individual behavior and ethics. And I'd say we within the evangelical community tend to do a pretty good job of this thus far. That I'd say that this is oftentimes how evangelicals are able to add a degree of seriousness and propriety and good living in corporate cultures and in public life in ways that we really need to do this. This is actually where I think that Christians in politics stand out more than anything else, is on individual ethics and behavior. In general, you hear the exceptional stories in the newspaper where people who fail their moral convictions, but in general, I'm pretty encouraged with what I see. But it's only the first step. And frankly, oftentimes in the church, this is where we stop. We also need to think of moral imagination as responsible citizenship. I mean, this, I'm not talking anything about sort of being an American citizen. What I'm saying is, how do we, as committed Christ followers, contribute to the flourishing of the world around us? How do we take responsibility for the flourishing of the community in which we live, of the environment, of the school where we go, of the work where we do? That's what I mean by being sort of fully engaged. And there's lots of ways that you can do it. This is a great story. Barry Rowan, who's the number two guy at Vonage, had the opportunity to go to be a doctor. And in the end, he said, I'm actually drawn to business because of the concept of leverage. That, you know, as a physician, I would be able to do some things really well. But if I'm a business leader, I get a chance to just have a much bigger scale and scope of influence. This is the story we need to talk about in the church. If there is revival that is to come in American society today, it will largely come through the business community. That is the environment where all of us spend the majority of our waking time, is at work, and it is the fundamental mechanism by which philanthropy is created for the entire social sector to work. And so we need to have a sense of how can we help committed Christ followers understand the leverage opportunities that are out there by being a distinctive Christian voice in the private sector. I'm quite persuaded after spending 10 years looking at it, interviewing hundreds of leaders, that's where there's real opportunity. So how does this actually happen? Well, one is we have to frankly figure out ways to maximize opportunities. This is a great story. Kevin Plank. Kevin Plank was a mediocre student. Barely got by passing school, ended up going to play football at the University of Maryland. While he was there, he was a mediocre player. He loved the game, but all of his friends were being recruited and drafted to the NFL, and he wasn't going anywhere. However, he was a smart guy who had a hard work ethic, and he'd always been a good salesman. He had been selling things since he was a kid. And one thing that stood out to him is just how unusual it was that people's performance on the playing field was really limited by their clothing. And he had this idea that, you know, all these people are wearing, these football players are wearing these t-shirts underneath the equipment, and the t-shirt would end up weighing 4 or 5 pounds because it was soaked with sweat at the end of a practice. Wouldn't it be interesting if there was some kind of fiber that would allow you to wick away that sweat so that folks wouldn't get weighed down? How much more would it improve performance? What Kevin did is he combined two things he was good at, a love for sports and selling things. He took his last $600 and invested in 6 different kinds of material to see if any of those would work. He was literally sleeping on his grandmother's couch when he launched the company Under Armour. This is the person who launched Under Armour, and it came because he figured out how to maximize the things that he was good at and to leverage those in the most effective way. One of the big important messages, I think, of the gospel is that you and I are not called to the individual responsibilities in the world in the same way. You may have a passion for human trafficking in a way that you don't. You may have a passion for educating young people in a way that you care more deeply about what's happening in the 2/3 world. We each have different passions. What you want to do is awaken that passion in our young people and help them to see how can they take that to turn it into making a real difference. Leveraging opportunity. Second, I'm convinced that if you really want to have long-term effectiveness as a top leader, you need to embrace what I call a liberal arts approach to life. Liberal arts approach is this idea that you're conversant on many different subjects. The whole way in which our workforce is structured is wrong because it rewards people for mastering a smaller and smaller domain so that you get to move up because you're an effective engineer over a particular area, when in fact, when you have to lead the whole enterprise, you need a much wider vision of how to make the business work. When I'm looking for young people in whom we're going to make investments, people I'm going to try and reach out to, I'm looking for folks who are able to hold an interesting conversation with lots of different kinds of people at a dinner party. See who are the good conversationalists. They are the people who have this liberal arts approach. They're dilettantes. They're able to talk about lots of different things. If you want to know the single subject that's most important for you to build a connection with the widest spectrum of people in our culture today, any guesses what that subject would be? Film, that's a good guess, but it's not film.
Sports.
Sports, that's right. This is Lynn Elsenhans. Lynn was the first woman to be CEO of an oil and gas company. She was the CEO of Sun Oil Company, Sunoco. She got that job in part because she could talk sports. Now, there's obviously the gender dynamics that are at work here, but it works for men as well. You have guys who really love sports and those who don't. But you need to be able to have a conversation with folks, at least about the NCAA championship game. You need to be able to sort of know who are the players and what's going on, because it allows you to build ties with folks that has no regard for rank or authority. If you have an ability to talk sports, you can build a relationship with a CEO and with a dock worker. That's what I mean by a liberal arts approach to life. Third, there is what we call the iceberg effect of leadership. It's interesting because I studied this for probably 3 or 4 years and just didn't think it was a reality. And then I myself moved into a senior leadership role and found out it is not just the reality, it's the governing principle of my life. The basic idea here is that a leader's best work never sees the light of day. I spend the majority of my time doing two things. One, I'm trying to make something good happen that in the end falls apart. A merger, recruiting a particular person, building a new program. I'm working really hard, and for whatever reason, it falls apart. Well, you never announce to the organization, hey guys, I spent the last 3 weeks working on something. In the end, it didn't work out, but just want you to know I've been busy on some things. No, you just don't talk about it. The second thing is I spend a lot of time trying to keep bad things from becoming public. Trying to make good things happen that don't materialize, trying to keep bad things from becoming public. Most of leadership happens below the surface. What you see above the surface, just the tip of the iceberg. And the best work that a leader does never gets publicly recognized. Fourth big idea that I encountered is how formative the crucible of crisis is. This is obviously the conversation where White House Chief of Staff Andy Carter is whispering into President Bush's ear. But the interesting thing about crisis is that it very rarely actually forms somebody's character. Very rarely. Most often it simply reveals it. Crisis has a way of drawing up to the surface personality traits, values, idiosyncrasies that sometimes lay dormant, that we don't pay attention to, but crisis has a way of bringing it up. And so it's very important to remember, if you're waiting for a moment when sort of your character is going to get shaped in crisis, actually, let me tell you, it doesn't happen very often. Character is something that is shaped over a long period of time, not in the crucible of the moment. Most young people don't understand that. That's why we tell our students it's really important for them to think about the spiritual habits that they practice as a college student. For some reason, all college students worldwide think that somehow they're going to have more time when they graduate than they do when they're a student. It's a common phenomenon. They show me their daytimers and say how jam-packed they are, and they just can't possibly imagine they fit something else in. And then I say, what are you going to do when you get a job? And you have to cook for yourself, and you have to clean up your apartment and pay bills. This is the reality that is coming to you. We develop the habits that we form, frankly, when we're in school, are habits that stay with us over our lifetime. Fifth, there is a real priestly dimension to leadership. The leader has to embody the values of its institution or organization. And so when there is that deep connection, like Steve Jobs at Apple, it works really well. And when you don't have that embodiment, it doesn't work well at all. There is a sense in which you lead as much with your life as you do with your role. It's how you carry yourself. Simple things. I was interviewing a young man for a job, and he's in a current job where he travels a lot. And so he has frequent flyer status, and he gets upgrades a great deal. It's interesting because I was picking him up from the airport, and he said, Dr. Lindsay, I haven't checked any bags, and I'm seated up toward the front, so I'll be off pretty quickly, and I'll meet you at the curbside. Now, I really paid attention to what he said, because he did not tell me he was seated in first class. And it was a subtle thing, because he was not trying to somehow, for some reason, people take great pride in when they get some kind of cool opportunity. But this is a guy who realized, actually, I'm not trying to show off here. I'm just trying to make a statement. We have to be able to embody the values and to make sure that there's integrity between who we are and what we espouse. Second, leaders are shaped by rituals, and family rituals are incredibly important. This is a word not just for developing leaders, but it's actually a word for how you could help those people in your church who already have leadership jobs right now, people who have busy roles and responsibilities. Most important thing you could do to help them with their family life is encourage them to establish some kind of set of family rituals. A weekly ritual that reminds the family we're normal. Dad may have a big job, mom might have a big job, but we have a sense of normalcy. And I found this happened all the time. Ralph Larson, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, he and his family had Sunday night pizza. It did not matter where he had to be on Monday, he was at home for Sunday night pizza. John Donahoe, the head of eBay, he does a similar thing. Sunday morning pancakes. Makes pancakes for his kids every Sunday morning. The ritual has a way of normalizing a family routine. And that's important not just for the family, but also for the person in responsibility. Third, integrity. The flip side of that embodying of values is that if there's not integrity between what you say and how you live your life out, it comes to hurt you. This is Glenn Tilton. He was the head of United Airlines. At the very time that he and senior management were trying to persuade the labor of United to make concessions on their contracts, to basically take pay cuts, he and his senior executives were ensconced in the Ritz-Carlton in Chicago. You cannot do that. It's the wrong kind of message. Integrity, one of the things that is seems so fundamental, but our actions speak so more, much more powerfully than our words. Another example, return back to Condoleezza Rice. She told me that one thing that she learned, that she said, I never fully appreciated until I was in the role as National Security Advisor, is how much my actions, even when they have nothing to do with my job, reflect on people's perception of my ability as a leader. She said, for example, in the midst of Hurricane Katrina, when New Orleans was underwater, she was attending the opening of the United Nations. And she said, I was really involved in the United Nations, and that was an important thing for me to be doing, and I needed to get a new pair of shoes. And she said, I should have been thinking about the fact that the rest of the country was fixated on what was happening in New Orleans and Katrina. And I should have sent an assistant out to go get me a pair of shoes. She said, instead, I went myself to Saks. And she said, what was the picture on the front page of the New York Times was me walking out of Saks with a couple of bags of new shoes. Here is our great government leader. They're really looking out for us. While New Orleans is underwater, she's off buying shoes. Integrity. A lot more can be accomplished when you have a bigger vision for what's possible. I close with the story of one man. This is Kiem Pham. Kiem Pham was a refugee in South Vietnam in 1977. As South Vietnam fell, Kiem and his family fled, and they became refugees, floating on the South China Sea for 3 months. While he was out on that South China Sea, they had a number of people who perished, including members of his own family. He ended up being resettled in the United States, lived in Colorado, and began to enroll in classes at CU Boulder. Now, he didn't speak much English at the time, so he decided he would attend some different guest lectures as a way of trying to bone up on his English. And one lecture he went to was a talk being given by his congressman, a man named Tim Worth. Tim Worth, in the course of the conversation and the lecture, said, you know, I'm in Congress right now, but I really got my start from this amazing program called the White House Fellowship. It's a program for folks in their 20s or 30s where they resign their jobs and they move to Washington for 1 year and go work for a cabinet secretary. It's a great opportunity and it really changed my life. Kiem Pham thought that sounded pretty interesting. Once he finished his degree and entered into the business world, he decided to apply for the White House Fellowship. However, he was rejected. One of the key things that I learned over the course of the study is that folks who succeed are not the most talented, they're just the most resilient. And so he applied a second time. After he had gone through the entire application process a second time, he still was rejected. But Kiem was undeterred, so he applied a third time. And on the third time, he was actually selected. This is in 1985. 8 years after he was floating in the South China Sea, he's shaking hands with President Reagan in the Oval Office. It was the main feature story on the Today Show that morning in September of 1985. He ended up going on to be a successful businessman and continued on his life journey. However, he stayed in touch with Tim Worth, who by that time had become a U.S. senator and then was nominated and served as an Undersecretary of State for Global Diplomacy. One day in the late 1990s, he went to go see Secretary Worth. They renewed their friendship, talked about that talk he had heard 20 years earlier, and said, you know, I'm just wondering, Tim, why is it that the U.S. government is doing so little to free the political prisoners that are in South Vietnam, many of whom have been held for nearly 30 years. Secretary Worth said, well, we've been trying to, but we haven't had much success. Our contacts are not that great, and the Vietnamese government is not really engaging us. Kim Pham said, you know, I've got some contacts there. If I came up with a strategy, would you encourage the ambassador to try and go for it just one time to see if it works? He said, sure enough. The secretary sent a cable to the ambassador. It was Pete Peterson at the time. And he said, a man's going to come see you named Kim Pham. Whatever he says, let's try it out for one time. What happened is Kim Pham was able to secure the release of one political prisoner in Vietnam. And when that occurred, he went to the ambassador and said, I want you to hold a press conference praising the Vietnamese government for this magnanimous act. Go over the top and saying how great they are. He said, we don't do this. One political prisoner? Give me a break. He said, no, just try it. So that's what happened. And it built some goodwill. About 3 weeks later, Kim Pham went back to his contact in the Vietnamese government. He said, you know, the Americans really liked it when you did that. Why don't we try it again? Just see if it works. He secured the release of a second political prisoner. The ambassador had another press release, held a press conference praising the government. And they went about this. This went on every 2 or 3 weeks for a year, securing one prisoner at a time. This was in 1998. In the run-up to the millennium, Kim Pham went to his contact and he said, you know, we're about to have Y2K, the Jubilee year. We've been going about this retail. Let's try going wholesale. I know for a fact there are 4,000 political prisoners that are being held in Vietnam at this time. Why don't you, in recognition of the Year of Jubilee, release all of them? Over that time, Kim Pham had built up a good bit of relational capital with his contacts in the government, and the U.S. government had been doing a good job of praising this small government for doing small, simple acts of human kindness by releasing these prisoners who had been held, really, for decades. In the end, Kim Pham was able to secure the release of all those political prisoners. But here's the most amazing thing about it all. Kim Pham was really excited about securing the release of that first person, and the second person, and the third person. But the entire journey he had been on since 1977 had really been around the idea of trying to help one man. As he's sitting in that boat in the South China Sea, he said he would fall asleep at night thinking about this one man. This very moment when this picture is taken, where he's shaking hands with President Reagan, glorious minute to be shaking hands with President, most powerful man in the world, and he's thinking about one man. And as he goes around trying to build up relational capital with the Vietnamese to see if he can secure their release, it was one person he had on his mind. It was his uncle, number 4,000 on that list, who walks today as a free man in the streets of San Francisco. We may think institutionally, but we act personally. That's how we develop leaders of integrity, people who work in a countercultural way, but advance the common good. Thank you. I think we have just a couple of minutes. If you have a question you'd like to pose, I'd be happy to try and answer it. Yes, sir.
With your three categories of mentors, do you see people having the capacity to play different roles in different people's lives, or do we gravitate towards one or the other?
It's a great question. So the three different categories of mentors, do we tend to sort of be the role model more than other times? Do we tend to be the social investor, or can we be all three to different people, or maybe to the same person at different times? Actually, we're incredibly nimble creatures. And we have this great ability to sort of target different kinds of needs and meeting different kinds of expectations. What I find is that the challenger is the one that requires the most moral authority. It's the one that you have to have the longest relationship with, and it's the one that you have to use most selectively. But the others you can certainly draw upon, and many times I've found individuals who are making those kind of investments along the way. Yeah. Yes, sir.
In your book, you talked about four different areas, I believe, entertainment, business, politics, and I'm missing the last one.
Business.
Who were a couple people that you interviewed and you walked away thinking, that is totally different than the caricature or the public persona perception of them? And you kind of marveled at who they are compared to how people view them.
Do you have one of those t-shirts? Because this man just won one of those. Because that has to be one of the most interesting questions I've been asked. The most counterintuitive, surprising individuals I encountered over the course of my research is Ken Starr. I walked into the interview with Ken Starr with the biggest grad student chip on my shoulder I could possibly have. I thought I knew who he was. I thought I knew what he looked like and had a real sort of attitude. And turns out he was the most charming, self-effacing, humble, earnest, authentic Christian I had encountered probably in public life. Interesting, amazing man, because when he took the job as the independent investigator for Whitewater, he was chosen for that job because Democrats and Republicans liked him so much. And most people were saying that he was rumored to be the next nominee to the Supreme Court when a Republican was in office. He had served as Solicitor General for President George H.W. Bush, one of the most successful people to argue before the Supreme Court in U.S. history. And he took this job, putting that, frankly, at risk. And I thought he might be a really bitter man, because if you follow the trajectory, you know that the first person who ended up being nominated by, the person who ended up being confirmed by a Republican administration was first nominated to be Associate Justice John Roberts. But then Chief Justice Rehnquist died, and John Roberts became nominated for Chief Justice. So I have to believe, sitting there across this table from Ken Starr, there are moments when he has to think, that could have been me. I could have possibly be the Chief Justice of the United States. And so I asked him, aren't you a little disappointed? And in a non-melodramatic way, he said, you know what? You understand life looking backward, but you live it going forward. And I just had to get to a place where I said, Lord, I'll be open to what you might call me to do, and it may or may not line up with the perfect vision I have for my life, but I'll try and be faithful in the individual steps. He really impressed me. Wow. Yes, sir. Would you mind giving him a book so he can read about it? It was about evangelicals in power. It's called Faith in the Halls of Power. I originally started trying to see if there were evangelicals in positions of responsibility who could talk about their faith in a public way, whether they were in business or Hollywood, and to try and sort of look at, nobody had actually looked at the religious lives of people in power. Strangely enough, nobody had done a comprehensive survey of that in social science. So that's what the project sought to try and do. In the back of that book, you'll see the semi-structured interview guide that I used. Basically, I had an hour-long interview from most folks, and we had about 35 minutes worth of questions that I asked everybody. Tell me about your faith journey. Do people know you're a Christian? If so, how? Are there times when you try and go quiet on your Christianity because it makes more sense? Tell me those situations. So I asked them those kinds of questions, and then about 25 minutes were more customized. I interviewed Sharon Watkins, the whistleblower at Enron, so I wanted to ask her different questions than I would ask James Baker, Secretary of State. They just had different experiences, and I wanted to try and cover as much as I could. Yes, ma'am.
Gender differences?
Tons of gender differences we found. Do you have a copy of Faith in the Halls of Power? May I give you one? There's a great section there about women in leadership. And in that particular study, what we found is that men and women are concerned about caring for their kids and work-life balance. Women just happen to be much more tortured by that balance. So men care about it, women are tortured about it. And I think that probably the most recent piece that Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote for The Atlantic about women can't have it all, that epitomizes exactly what the women I was interviewing. Tammy Heim, who was the president of Borders Books, she had it was interesting. Over the course of the interviews, 30% of the people I interview wept at some point in time in the interview. I remember Tammy, because she teared up. And when I tried to figure out what it was that caused, I was not trying to elicit tears, it just somehow came out. I tried to figure out what was the question. It was one question that brought it to the surface more than other times. Has your professional success ever cost you something personally? And people told tremendous stories in that moment. Sure. There's real generational differences here, so I would say that folks who are over 50, the gender lines are pretty sharp and people are pretty uncomfortable with that. I'd say that as more women have entered into the workforce, and frankly, as more women have risen into positions of leadership, the mentoring dimension hasn't been as strong. The one thing I'll say is that on sort of personal issues, and particularly spiritual accountability, I do think you have to really make sure sex, money, and power are the three things that trip us up. And the gender dynamics can be part of that. We build relational ties that are pretty deep when we share our heart's deepest feelings. And so I myself try to be pretty careful about that and also try to encourage a culture where I can mentor women, but I might have a slightly different relationship with the women students who work in my office versus the men students, particularly around that particular issue. Yes, sir. The study does not exist on a global scale, though many of the people I interviewed are global leaders. I logged about 400,000 frequent flyer miles working on the project. Still enjoy those miles to this day. And the lessons, I gave a talk in Hong Kong about 4 months ago, and I had 20 CEOs, and they all resonated with the same ideas. So I do think that they're sort of global experiences. What we find is that the experiences have really less to do about geography and more about sort of station in life and complexity of organizations. So I'd love for there to be a global study. It cost a lot of money to do this particular project. If I had to do it all over again, I would have found a sugar daddy to give me more money so I had spent less Saturday nights in a dinky hotel by LAX airport where I was trying to get the Saturday night stay cheapo airline fare from Princeton, New Jersey. Probably the most important thing I do differently. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that revivals that happen.
Yeah, I really believe that spiritual renewal, wider cultural spiritual renewal, in order for it to take root in our culture, is going to require the endorsement and the active work of business leaders. I spent a decent amount of time as part of this project, especially early on in the study, trying to figure out, you know, what are the most strategic sectors and what are things happening? It's interesting, new ideas never come from politics. Politics is just the ratification of public opinion. I could only find one instance where Congress was ahead of the American public in the 20th century, and it was around civil rights. That was the only time. And they weren't ahead of the entire country, they were just ahead of a portion of the American South. That's the only time. Every other time, Congress is just ratifying public opinion. New ideas tend to start in the academy and the arts. And if you had to say, where specifically do those new ideas come out of? It's the Bay Area of San Francisco and Boston, actually. Those are the two cultural centers where new ideas, because you have a concentration of both world-class artists, world-class artistic institutions, and world-class universities, are all in close proximity. And so that's where the gay rights movement, it started in those two poles. And it worked its way into the country. DC, just the ratification of public opinion. That said, if you want something to be institutionalized for long-term change, the business community is the way in which it occurs. How do we know that the issue about gay rights changed? When did it change in our culture? Soap was the first sitcom to have a sympathetic gay character in 1977. But things did not change really until about 1997 when corporate America began to recognize same-sex benefits of domestic partners. That's really when things really changed. Corporate America is the engine that changes cultures. Yeah. One more question. Yes, sir.
I'm tempted to talk to you about sports, but I won't do that. Thanks for a great presentation. This is an excellent visual of the life, so I'd just love to hear your perspective.
Yes, sir. Make sure this man gets a Gordon College t-shirt so he can help me be an apologist for those liberal arts education. I would say that higher education has never been more challenged than it is at this very moment. And I say that not because I'm an educator, but because I'm a social scientist. You've never seen more people questioning the value of higher education in ways that make no sense. People, if you want to know who is really hurting in this economy, it is not college graduates. It's the people who do not finish college. The question is, how do we deliver college education at a price point that people can afford, right? Because you continue to see this skyrocketing price. It's interesting, most people do not realize how much we depend upon philanthropy to make the American system of higher education, which is the global standard. The world comes to study in the U.S. because we're the very best model of higher education. It's also the most expensive. We also have the most expensive medical system. The difference is that higher education has so much more of an engine driven by philanthropy. At Gordon, for example, our total sticker price, if you have somebody who pays the full amount, which is about $40,000, only 10% of our students come close to that. So 90% of our students don't even do that. But if you do even that student has received a gift from us of $13,000 per year. Because of philanthropy from other folks. The cost of educating a student at Gordon is $53,000. And it's true for that's true for all kinds of institutions. You say, well, why is it so much more? Have you been to a college campus lately? No longer is it just about having a dorm room which has a bunk and a dresser. You got to have, you know, sports facilities and wireless internet access where students are watching movies in real time. These are expensive amenities that we have. What I think will probably be happening is that there's going to be a consolidation in higher education. I don't think institutions will die. Colleges are like churches. They don't die, they just languish. So it's not like it's going to go totally out of business, but you will see that there'll be some consolidation. I also think that there's going to be more opportunities for institutions. I happen to be blessed at one of the best Christian liberal arts colleges in the world. I'm very bullish on the future of our kinds of institutions because we have people in Brazil begging to come to a school like ours. They see that there's no opportunity. There's no model for Christian higher education in the world outside of the United States. And so people really want to do that. There are some isolated pockets. You know, I think about Daystar in Africa. They're different, McKinsey in Sao Paulo, but very few. So the future, I think, of higher education is going to be much more global in scale. I think that your kids and grandkids are all going to be going to college with people from around the world. It's pretty exciting to me, actually. I think that it's a way in which we can rub shoulders and have a much more formative influence, but it also creates some real challenges that we got to navigate in the days ahead. Listen, you guys have been very nice. Thanks so much for coming.